This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Stay-at-home orders, changing tech. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The coronavirus is rearranging where and how we work. That means potential changes to things like laptop designs and browsers. We'll have examples.
Has the coronavirus pandemic been a blessing in disguise? An expert explains how it can help us prepare for future disasters.
The New Jersey church that has sparked a movement after one of its members fell ill with COVID-19.
And the dilemma facing sports. When will fans want to attend games and be side by side again?
Right now, a lot of leagues and organizations are going through what I think is a pretty academic exercise, is trying to set dates and find places down the road where they think, in their own opinions, it might be safe to hold sporting events again.
Wall Street Journal reporter Joshua Robinson on fans who might not be ready when ballparks and stadiums reopen. Well, for many days after the first positive test as the coronavirus silently spread through the New York region, Governor Andrew Cuomo, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, and their top aides projected confidence that the outbreak would be readily contained. At one point, Governor Cuomo said, "We don't even think it's going to be as bad as it was in other countries." But now, New York City and the surrounding suburbs have become the epicenter of the pandemic in the U.S., with far more cases than many countries have. It's a story by J. David Goodman, politics reporter at the New York Times. David, what have you found?
One of the things that we discovered was, you know, New York, once they started moving to address this crisis, you know, it took a lot of the steps that you would want to be taken in other places in the country that are experiencing this. But they did so later than might have helped to stem this. And so that's why you see the kinds of numbers of dead and hospitalized and in the intensive care units that you do in New York State. What we found was that there were warnings and indications early on that this was going to get quite bad, and it was already past the point at which it was controllable in the sort of normal playbook way. And officials here moved slower than was necessary to keep the numbers down. Now, the thing that they've said, and the governor and the mayor have pointed to, and which is true, is that they were really operating with one hand tied behind their back because the federal government had severely limited the kinds of tests and the kinds of people that could get tests in January and February. So this virus was starting to spread in through the country and into New York, and there's just no good way for epidemiologists to really locate it.
Wow. All right. So I know there's no playbook for this pandemic. So, you know, hindsight is 20/20. But for next time, has anybody said yet in New York City or more broadly New York State what will happen or how they'll address it or maybe
still
start preparing?
That's right. I mean, they're still thinking about the after action. You know, what do we learn here? What can we do better next time? I think the bigger concern is for other areas of the country that are looking at this and thinking, you know, we don't have a lot of sick people here right now, so we have time to deal with this. And that's really what they thought in New York. They approached it in the beginning as if, you know, each case was the only one that was here. They kind of moved slowly. And that's understandable. You know, we've never really seen anything like this in modern times, at least. And the kinds of measures you need to take to stop it once it's out in the community are quite drastic, as we've seen. I mean, to shut down New York City was not something that anyone thought even possible at the beginning of March. And suddenly, by the middle of March, it was the necessary thing to do it. In fact, our reporting found that that was even late, that if they had moved a few days earlier, even a week earlier, they could have saved a lot of people. But, of course, hindsight is 20/20, and to look at what they knew in the moment and to put yourself in the position of a governor or a mayor of a state and say, you know, did you act on the information that you had in a way that no mayor or governor had acted before? I think there you could debate whether that would have been possible politically.
Yeah.
But what we know now is that this virus doesn't care about your politics, and it moves very quickly as people take days or weeks to decide what to do. It's moving in hours through populations.
We're speaking with J. David Goodman, politics reporter at The New York Times. His piece is called How Delays and Unheeded Warnings Hindered New York's Virus Fight. One of the other points you made, too, was this showed how the virus overwhelmed the city's longstanding preparations, as you wrote, leaving officials to improvise. What was an example of that or two?
What they had done in the beginning was assume that they could isolate, track and contain the virus when it popped up. And that is the real playbook. There's sort of steps that they go through. And New York City's had a pandemic response for a long time, and the hospitals were sort of knew what to do, and the health departments knew what to do. But they very quickly got overwhelmed because it was apparent that the first four cases that were confirmed in New York City had nothing to do with each other. And so suddenly you're not just tracking how does this one person spread it to that person, but you're saying here's four nodes and we have to track all of those. And because they don't have anything to do with each other, that means they got it from somewhere else. And it just kind of hurdles you into the next stage, which is trying to mitigate it much more quickly than you might have been prepared to do.
When did the tone of, say, the New York City mayor or the governor start to change?
You really saw a change in that beginning and certainly through the middle of the third week in March. So you have feelings of confidence through the beginning, and then they kind of move into an effort to not get people to panic, that, yes, it looks bad, but we're going to get this under control. And then when you get to that, really, there's a weekend in the middle of March, at that point, the mayor and the governor have ordered large gatherings halted. Anything over 500 people was not allowed anymore. And they ordered restaurants and bars to cut their occupancy by half. But even so, that weekend, New Yorkers went out and partied, and young people were out in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is a nightlife hotspot. And this was alarming to people that were looking at the numbers, saying, you know, this is how this disease spreads. This is, you know, these people may not even be symptomatic, but they're going to bring it back to their families. They're going to bring it onto the subway.
All right. Thanks, David. J. David Goodman, politics reporter at The New York Times.
You're a small business owner, and there's nothing small about what you do. That's why Dell Small Business Technology Advisors give you trusted advice, one-on-one partnership, and tailored tech solutions, like computers with Intel Core processors, servers, storage, networking, plus thousands of top-brand electronics, accessories, and software. No matter your technology needs, Dell is here to help your small business do big things. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Glad you're with us. Is it possible that the coronavirus pandemic, with the chaos created around the globe, has done the world a favor? Disaster expert and author Dave Stevens thinks so. He's a former Navy commander and trained F-18 pilot. He's with us from Tennessee. Dave, how has it done us a favor?
I know that sounds very strange, and I'm not trying to be insensitive. In fact, I've lost a couple friends just very recently. But you have to look at kind of the big picture. You have to step back. And the bottom line is it's testing our response to a global pandemic, and it's showing us what works and obviously what doesn't work. There are some future viruses. For example, the Spanish flu, by some estimates, killed 10% of the world's population. And the people most at risk were actually 25 and younger. And Ebola had and some of the outbreaks had a 90% fatality rate. So if you tie that to this incubation period, we could be in serious danger.
All right, this won't be our last pandemic, obviously. Do you think that we come away from this one better prepared next time, or is that not the U.S. way?
Well, that's up to us, as you know. I mean, will we learn from it? You know, the tendency is immediately to start pointing fingers, and I know there's accountability required, but what we have to do is learn from what happened. The seasonal flu, according to the CDC, on average, 37,000 Americans a year. That's almost 300 a day during the flu season. What is different here is that we've never seen a flu with this type of incubation period. That's the first thing we have to learn. How do we identify the outbreaks quickly, faster, and then how do we isolate faster? And we can do this. I mean, we're the human race is very good at adapting, but we have to learn.
If we were better prepared, would we not have had to go into these stay-at-home orders?
I don't know. I think isolation for this type of an incubation virus is almost essential. But we might have been able to nip it in the bud and stop it in China, or at least slow it down to the point it wasn't such a big impact. One of the things I unfortunately believe about the human race is we have to get hit in the face, you know, before we really take action, before we think something is serious. I sometimes joke about this, but obviously pandemics aren't the only threat. One of the big threats, believe it or not, are asteroids and comets. And I keep thinking if we could just have one smash into the Sahara Desert, big enough to cause a lot of damage but not hurt anybody, that would wake us up.
We're speaking with Dave Stevens. He's a disaster expert, one-time Navy commander and trained F-18 pilot. He says we may have been done a favor by going through the coronavirus pandemic. What do you think has to change to make us less fragile as a society or an economy?
That's a critical question. I was even shocked. But, you know, the disasters are bad enough without bankrupting companies and crashing stock markets. You know, keep in mind, this pandemic isn't the only international disaster we'll face. I think businesses and economies have to build up some reserves. We have to be able to weather a temporary shutdown. And a good example is online presence. It, you know, used to be nice to have. Now it's essential. I mean, our entire global economy went online in a couple of weeks. And, you know, obviously we understand retailers have to go online, but her daughter was kind of funny. She just finished yesterday a virtual gym workout, and she's going to be going to a virtual happy hour. Yeah. So there are ways even conventional businesses can move online, but now they're going to have to.
Do you think that we need to practice as citizens for next time, you know, like the way the military conducts its exercises sometimes?
I think one of the big things is every household, this is my opinion, but every household should have at least 2 weeks of stockpile so they don't have to make a store run. And no, I'm not talking about turning everybody into a prepper or survivalist, but the bottom line is, and people think, well, you know, that's being fear-mongering or that's being selfish. It's exactly the opposite. If you have a stockpile of 2 weeks of non-perishables and basic necessities, you don't have to raid the store. You're not putting extra strain and pressure on local infrastructure. You now have the ability to maybe help out some neighbors who don't have the means or access. And finally, let me caveat this. Wait until after the crisis has passed. You don't want to be hoarding. But after that, you know, if everybody buys up a nice stockpile, guess what? That'll also help restart our stalled economy.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Dave Stevens, former Navy commander and trained F-18 pilot and disaster expert. It's 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Everything begins with an idea, but how do you bring it to life? If your idea requires graphic design, copywriting, web programming, or some other skill, how do you locate that help? For the talent you need at a price you can afford, the answer is Fiverr. Fiverr connects you to a network of trusted freelance talent that's worked on some of the most influential brands in the world. Fiverr talents offer hundreds of digital services that you can search by service, deadline, price, reviews, and more. With Fiverr, there are no unknowns. You'll know exactly what you're paying for upfront with no negotiation. And Fiverr's talents are proven to ensure you get the expertise you need to bring your idea to life. And when you give Fiverr a try now, you'll save. Check out Fiverr.com today and use my code Gordon to receive 10% off your first order. It's so easy. Find all the digital services you need in one place at Fiverr.com, code Gordon. Again, that's Fiverr.com and the code Gordon. Try Fiverr today. Thanks for being with us. Sports will eventually return. Athletes will head back to work in arenas, ballparks, and stadiums, and leagues will promise a return to normalcy. There will finally be something to watch on television again, too. But there are some people who might not be ready so quickly. The fans. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
We don't know when, but sports certainly will come back at some point. But as Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal writes, the big question will be how sports comes back and how fans come back. Joshua, from your research and the people you talk to for your story, what's the landscape looking for in general for sports?
Well, right now, a lot of leagues and organizations are going through what I think is a pretty academic exercise of trying to set dates and find places down the road where they think, in their own opinions, it might be safe to hold sporting events again. You know, you look at the French Open, for instance, claiming a date in September. Sure, but we really don't know. So I think the outlook right now is heavily dependent on a pretty unpredictable virus. So all the leagues right now are just sitting tight, and they're up against a huge, huge challenge to get back even in 2020.
Will it be feasible to have any sports come back where fans are not present?
That was certainly the approach before the full shutdowns happened in Europe. We had some soccer matches go behind closed doors, and that was something that was tested, and it's in the thinking for how sports might come back, but it's not that compatible with isolation. I mean, even if you are going to, and this is just an example, say hold the NBA playoffs in a place like Vegas and bring everyone into a kind of bubble and isolate all the players, even that would take 6-8 weeks. And that 6 or 8 weeks when the players are away from their families, cooped up in hotels, that's not an ideal situation either. So they're really at a point where they have to figure out, one, when it's logistically possible to start holding events again, when the players might be able to do it, and then down the road, really, when they might have fans again, because fans are going to be the toughest people to convince.
We're speaking with Joshua Robinson of the Wall Street Journal. I was going to say the people making the decisions, are they measuring the feeling of the fan and trying to get some behavioral guidance on this as well?
It's tough to gauge at the moment. The leagues themselves, I don't think, are really plugged into what the fans might want immediately or long term, because it's hard to envision right now what that might look like when sports do come back. The president himself has said he wants sports back as soon as possible. But again, the idea right now of going to a stadium with 40,000 people is really tough to kind of wrap my head around. And I think it's true for a lot of people who are undergoing the lockdown. I've heard from people who, even when they're watching TV now, see people shake hands or hug and think, oh, you're not supposed to do that anymore.
Joshua, do you think there are players who will be willing to come back if there is not a vaccine in place?
There will be some, but the players are reluctant to do two things. One is to come back without a vaccine, and two is to play in front of empty stadiums. That's not what they're in this business for. And even LeBron James has said that he would rather play in full arenas, and otherwise he doesn't really see the point. The owners and league officials may see it differently, especially in the general direction sports are moving in 2020, which is, yes, it's an event in a stadium, but really it's a TV product before anything else. The stadiums are effectively sound stages.
Is anyone envisioning a future where fans are actually scanned in some way for temperatures or something like that?
No one's put forward a proposal like that yet in the States, but you could imagine it. It was certainly happening in airports at the very beginning of the outbreak, and it would not be out of the realm of possibility to see that in stadiums. They're going to have to come up with some kind of monitoring or widespread testing, of course, before people can really be allowed, or before cities and states will really feel comfortable sanctioning these mass gatherings again.
Thanks, Joshua. Joshua Robinson from the Wall Street Journal with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Let me tell you about my new favorite way to pass the time while commuting. It's the app called Blinkist. Blinkist works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books and whittles it down to just 15 minutes. Successful people like business leaders are well known for reading self-improvement books. I just finished listening to Snowball, a Warren Buffett biography. Listen to Blinkist while commuting or maybe exercising, even while you're waiting for your kids to finish practice. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestseller lists, as well as the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read. I also like listening to some of the history titles, since I never had much good history in school. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/morning to try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/morning to start your free 7-day trial. You'll also save 25%, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/morning. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, how COVID-19 should change laptop designs. Also, what to put in a COVID-19 emergency home care kit, and the New Jersey church sparking a movement. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, the plot, the script, and the characters may have changed, but we've seen this movie before. The recent stock market swoon strikes many folks as unprecedented. It's the frantic financial sideshow to a devastating global tragedy. But Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com says on closer inspection, 2020's bear market doesn't seem so different from earlier market declines. Once again, we're being reminded of some crucial facts of financial life. He's got a list of them. Jonathan set this up.
You know, a lot of people are saying that the current stock market decline is unprecedented, and in a sense it is. I mean, we have not for a century had a pandemic like this that has rocked the economy, you know, caused such widespread death and generated such fear. So in that sense, yes, what is going on in the financial markets and the world at large is indeed unprecedented. And yet, when you look a little closer at it, this looks a whole lot like many of the other market declines that we've experienced over recent decades.
You point out in point number one here that in these times, investors toss out basic commandments like buy low, sell high. Why do we do this?
We have, on the one hand, what's called a risk capacity. It's our objective ability to handle risk. But then, on the other hand, we also have our so-called risk tolerance, which is how we feel emotionally about the market. And that changes over time. When stock prices are rising, we grow more confident. You know, we look at our fat gains. We think about how smart we are. And then when that reverses, you know, those feelings go into reverse. We suddenly become super uncertain about what we're doing. We lose all confidence. We hate losing money. And for a certain segment of the investing population, all of this leads them to hit the panic button and sell out. Now, that, of course, is the worst thing you can do during a market decline. It's panic, you know, after we've already suffered steep losses.
Yeah. Your point number three, you talk about in treasuries we should trust. Explain that.
So if you go back to the 2008 market decline, pretty much the only investment that posted gains that year were treasury bonds. At times of crisis, people flocked to treasury bonds because even if they're worried about their local municipality not paying the interest on their bonds, even if they're concerned that corporations won't meet their obligations, and certainly that they're fearful about stocks, they know that the U.S. government, with its taxing power, is going to be able to make the payments on its bonds. And yet, people dislike owning treasury bonds as portfolio protection. And I think the clear reason is because yields are so low. And yet, once again, this time around, the one thing that would have saved your portfolio is owning treasury bonds. But people, for some reason, would much prefer to go off and buy exotic fare, you know, liquid alt mutual funds, hedge funds, Bitcoin, real estate stocks, something more sophisticated than just plain old treasury bonds. But treasury is the place to be at a time like this.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece about the facts of financial life. I thought it was interesting, too. You said if we wait for stocks to get cheap before buying, we'll likely wait an awful long time. What do you mean?
Well, there are two things to keep in mind here. One is over the past 40 years, we've seen a gradual rise in stock market valuation. Stocks are clearly more expensive than they have been historically. I mean, part of that is driven by falling interest rates, but part of it is that people are just more willing to take risks. They're more comfortable with the global economy, and so that's driven up valuations over time, and it seems very unlikely that we will return to historic norms. Second, and this is particularly critical to the months ahead, during a period like this where we have a sharp economic contraction, corporate earnings are going to look terrible, and dividends are likely to be cut. And one of the consequences of those two things is price-earnings ratios are going to look much higher than normal, and that suggests the stock market is super expensive. And two, the market's dividend yield may come down because of those dividend cuts. And so if you look at just those two yardsticks, you're going to say, wow, stocks are expensive, I shouldn't own them. And yet, when the market drops 20, 30%, that's a time when you should be buying.
Jonathan Clements, founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com.
For the ones standing guard, for the eagle-eyed, for the knights in shining armor, and for all those who support them. We are Grainger, offering supplies and solutions for every industry, plus free access to specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Glad you're with us. The new coronavirus is changing where and how we work, as you know, and that will affect how the tools we use, like browsers and laptops, evolve to address new threats and needs. Rob Enderle, founder of The Enderle Group, says in computerworld.com that the risks include fake news and needs include unique hardware requirements that have more to do with productivity than, say, portability. Rob, explain.
Typically, when we deploy laptops, we deploy them to people that are highly mobile. So the parameters are it's got to be very portable, it's got to have lots of battery life, it's got to be really light. But with COVID-19, we're talking about people that are simply, rather than working at work, they're working from home. And for the most part, their mobility is limited to maybe their home office or their kitchen table or their couch or maybe their bench outside or wherever it is they're moving around the house. They're not highly mobile. They're going from station to station. They generally have power, so they don't necessarily need long battery life. But they want the same kind of experience they had in the office, but without wanting to really haul a monitor around, because in many cases they're just not set up for a dedicated home office. They haven't been working at home before, so why would they have a home office? They probably were doing a lot of their home stuff from the regular office.
Yeah.
And the other rooms, they still have kids at home, and they've got to watch the kids. They're around their pets. They've got all these things that they didn't really come into play when they were selecting a laptop, when people were selecting laptops prior to COVID-19. And so the end result is they're looking for larger screens, a more desktop-like experience, and that results in a very different piece of hardware.
All right, so do you think we're looking at potentially here a laptop evolution?
I think so. I was just on the phone with BlackBerry this morning, and they were talking about the fact that a lot of their clients are talking about going, rather than looking at this as a transitory practice of work at home, really flipping and making it be the rule. So most of the employees continue to work at home even after COVID is over. And that way, of course, if you have a pandemic or another disease or another problem, the people are home safe and they don't have to go through this massive disruption ever again, and they can cut down on office expense. They can recover a lot of the lost productivity time for transport, people commuting to and from the office. And since they'll have to implement a lot of the remote working capabilities anyway, why not just leave them in place and make use of them and really learn to use the benefits?
We're speaking with Rob Enderle, principal and founder of The Enderle Group. He's written a piece for computerworld.com entitled How COVID-19 Should Change Laptop and Browser Priorities. How about on the browser front, Rob?
Well, one of the big problems we've got right now, VPN Research is one of the independent firms that apparently has been looking at activity on the web, has reported that there are now 35,500 websites. Well, actually, that was as of April 2nd. They've been going up over 1,000 a day. Websites that are, not only delivering malware, but giving false information on COVID-19. And that level of false information is a real problem, because people are doing stupid stuff. You probably read about the couple that decided to take fish tank cleaning stuff because it used the same active ingredient as the one the president was touting for mitigation. And one of them died, and last I heard, the other one was still in critical care. So getting around that false information is very important. Microsoft rolled out their new Chromium Edge browser, and it was uniquely designed to be able to handle a lot of these problems with enhancements in privacy, enhancements in security, enhancements in usability, and hopefully it's one of the tools you can now use to keep you away from some of these hostile sites.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, founder of The Enderle Group. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. If you or a family member gets infected with the coronavirus, it is very likely that you'll have to ride it out at home, since most COVID-19 cases do not require hospitalization. So people should be prepared to care for themselves or their loved ones under their own roof. Hillary Potkowitz, contributor at the Wall Street Journal, asked doctors at top hospitals all over the country what they would include in their ideal COVID-19 home care kit. Hillary, what do they suggest?
Yes, the first order of business, every single doctor said, was to isolate the patient in whatever way you can. If you have a spare bedroom with its own bathroom, that's ideal, but a lot of people don't have that. So if it's a one-bedroom apartment, the sick person gets the bedroom. Like all the doctors said, it's worth disrupting the rest of the family to keep the sick person isolated. And you also need to have some kind of face mask for both the sick person and anybody who is taking care of them or comes into contact or whatever. If there ever, you know, someone's going into the room, both people have to be wearing a face mask or covering. If the sick person who's not really supposed to come out of the room, but obviously if they have to go to the bathroom or whatever, they need to put on a mask when they leave the room, and you need to wash everything they touch.
Yeah, I didn't realize how strict some of these doctors wanted you to be too. I mean, they essentially said, if at all possible, don't even come out of the room.
Exactly. I mean, I think that would be everyone's preference, but not everyone, you know, can have an ensuite bathroom.
Right.
But there were a couple of things that I didn't really think of, I guess. And some of the doctors recommended that for a shared bathroom, that the healthy people in the house should take all of their toiletries out of the bathroom. Like, you don't want toothbrushes anywhere near each other. And if you think about it, like putting toothpaste on your toothbrush, I mean, you cannot have people sharing the toothpaste too, right? The sick person has to have their own toothpaste. And the sick person should not use the hand towel that everybody in the family uses to dry their hands. They should have a roll of paper towels and bring the paper, disposable paper towels to use when they go into the bathroom to wash their hands and dry their hands and everything.
Speaking with Hillary Potkowitz, contributor to the Wall Street Journal, her piece is called What to Put in a COVID-19 Emergency Home Care Kit. How about on the medicine side?
Sure. Most of the doctors said that you should have your regular cold and over-the-counter cold and flu medication that you normally take, that's super helpful. They recommended acetaminophen or Tylenol. And there are a couple of gadgets that seemed to everyone thought was a good idea. And one is a thermometer. A lot of people have them, but some people don't. A thermometer and something called a pulse oximeter, which is a little thing about the size of a candy bar, I guess, that clips onto your finger and measures your heart rate and your oxygen, the blood oxygen levels, like the amount of oxygen that's saturated in your blood. It tells you basically how well your lungs are working.
Thanks, Hillary. Hillary Potkowitz, contributor to The Wall Street Journal. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend.
You're a small business owner, and there's nothing small about what you do. That's why Dell Small Business Technology Advisors give you trusted advice, one-on-one partnership, and tailored tech solutions, like computers with Intel Core processors, servers, storage, networking, plus thousands of top-brand electronics, accessories, and software. No matter your technology needs, Dell is here to help your small business do big things. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
Thanks for being with us. A New Jersey church has sparked a nationwide movement after shipping a care package to one of its members who tested positive for the coronavirus. Chris Moranti, the pastor of Evangel Church in Scotch Plains, launched Boxes of Hope, which nationwide is through getboxesofhope.com. He told Fox News that the mission field is across the street and around the world, so they began to mobilize as soon as they saw the crisis start. The church partnered with Convoy of Hope and World Help, two disaster relief organizations, after they learned that a member of the flock had tested positive for COVID-19. He said they just delivered some groceries in a box to their front door. But after they saw the hope it brought to one family, they started doing it en masse, shipping out 600 boxes in the New Jersey area. Mr. Moranti said the response has been amazing, with some people coming to the front door in tears. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.